If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Monday, June the 4th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Commander Michael Nordine. Representing the United States Navy, Commander Nordine is a National Security Affairs Fellow here at the Hoover Institution. He is the former CEO of Strike Fighter Squadron 211, assigned to the aircraft carrier USS Harry S. Truman. He served multiple operational tours flying combat missions in F-14 and F-18 aircraft and has been awarded 6 air medals, one with combat valor. Commander Nordine is a distinguished graduate of West Point with a degree in mechanical engineering, holds a master's degree in international economics from St. Petersburg State University, Russia, where he previously studied as an Olmsted Scholar and an MBA with greatest distinction from Valeric Business School. Commander Nordine's research interests include innovation in the defense industry and the contribution of economic strength to national defense. To say that is impressive would be an understatement, but it does raise at least 2 questions, Commander Nordine. Number one, how does one go from West Point to naval aviation? And then secondly, perhaps more importantly, what happens when Army plays Navy in football? Are you like the president? Do you go on both sidelines, or who do you root for?
That's a great question, Bill, and thanks again for having me on this morning. I had always wanted to fly F-14s from the time I was a child. I watched Top Gun when I was a 13-year-old. My father took me to air shows, and so it was always a goal of mine. And I had enlisted in the Army to fly helicopters. I went to West Point, and I honestly had kind of put that goal aside and then later on realized that there was an opportunity to transition. So they let up to 1% of the graduating class from West Point and the Naval Academy switch, mm-hmm. as long as there's a candidate from the Naval Academy that commissions in the Army.
Okay, so it's a one-for-one swap.
It's a one-for-one swap. And there were two individuals that year, myself and another West Point grad, Sean Hall, and we both went to flight school down in Pensacola.
All right. Your commitment with the Navy then is what? How many years as an aviator?
So after winging, it's an 8-year commitment.
After going to Pensacola and getting your...
Yeah, so that nominally takes about 2 years to get mm-hmm. through that training process to become a winged aviator. And then there's an 8-year commitment on top of that. So you're all in 10 years if you want to fly fighters in the Navy.
Mm-hmm. And you knew all along you wanted F-14s.
I wanted F-14s. I got F-14s, and I flew them for my first operational assignment. And then they were decommissioned in the mid-2000s, and I transitioned to F-18s after that.
How many people were in your class at Pensacola?
Oh, boy. So you start off in an aviation pre-flight indoctrination mm-hmm. where there's anywhere between 45 and 60 candidates, and that's when you're learning about aerodynamics and engine theory,
right.
navigation. And then you'll class up in Whiting or in Kingsville, Texas. At the time, we were flying the T-34 Mentor. Mm-hmm. They're now flying a T-6 Texan, which is a upgraded, modernized airplane with a glass cockpit. It's more similar to what we're flying in the fleet now.
Right.
And I don't exactly remember. I think that those classes were pretty small, 15, 20 folks at most that started going through the T-34 program. And then it whittles down and you head in different directions. So you can go helicopters after a certain point. So you solo in the T-34 and then mm-hmm. the class breaks up and heads in different directions for helicopters, maritime patrol,
transportation,
and then fighters.
Right. Do most of the candidates coming in, do they want to do fighters or?
I'd say it varies because there's a little bit of lifestyle difference. So there's different personalities are attracted to different platforms. But mm-hmm. Certainly for me, there was no doubt in my mind. I went there. I wanted to fly fighters. I wanted to fly the F-14. And you do have to excel in flight school in order to get selected to fly fighters. So you're going to have to work hard during that process, study and practice extra time in the simulators. And just be prepared for your next training evolutions if you want to get selected.
What is the physical side of training at Pensacola? You have to do what, survival training and?
So the you don't do survival training in Pensacola, but you will do so after you're a winged aviator and prior to training on your fleet platform. So before I went and flew F-14s, you go to SEER school then. Mm-hmm. And it's a couple weeks up in Brunswick, Maine. There's another one out in San Diego.
Okay. And how do you practice carrier landings?
So
I mean, it doesn't take you out in the ocean and say there's an aircraft carrier land. You must be doing some sort of dry land simulation beforehand.
You do. Right? So you're going to go through a lot of procedural training in the simulator. But, I would say just take it back to the first time you get in an airplane, the Navy trains carrier-based pilots.
Yeah.
So we're flying angle of attack approaches, which is a constant angle as opposed to flaring to land like you do in an Air Force or a civilian airliner. So we're hitting the ground at a certain angle of attack, and that's drummed into your head from the first day. So we'll fly the carrier approaches in a T-34, which is a specific type of turn, and then eventually you'll practice on a outlying field during intermediate flight training when you're first flying jets. I flew the T-2 Buckeye at the time, and they have a carrier deck painted on the runway at the end of the runway. And the Fresnel lens that we use, it's an optical landing system that gives a visual indication of the glide path that you're flying. Mm-hmm. That's right there in the same position on that field as it would look on a carrier deck. And you do this hundreds of times. And after every single training flight, you're going to make five or six approaches, and you're graded and evaluated on every single one of those passes.
How many carrier landings have you made in your career?
500.
500. Mm-hmm. You keep a count.
Yes, it's in my logbook.
Okay.
So I don't know the precise number. It's right around 500.
Right around 500. Any close calls?
No close calls on the deck. I mean, I've certainly when you're new, you definitely get waved off by the landing signal officers a couple times. You'll definitely you'll make an approach and miss the wires and have to go around. We call that a bolter. Uh-huh. Over time, you really start to develop a skill for it, and you know it almost becomes second nature. You just do it so much.
Right. So in commercial aviation, they say the two greatest challenges are what in terms of accidents, takeoffs and landing. Right. Mm-hmm. So in naval aviation, which is the greater challenge? Is it getting the? It's what it's called a cold launch, isn't it?
When a catapult launch.
Catapult launch, but I think it's called a cold launch, isn't it? When you don't get steam and you just get tossed over.
Yes, that was
But which is more frequent? Is it that mishap or is it a landing mishap?
That's really uncommon. Mm-hmm. A cold cat would be a really uncommon occurrence. There's really robust safety procedures in place to prevent that from happening.
Right.
But you're prepared for it every time you get on the catapult. Every time you line up on a catapult, you're prepared for this to occur. So you mentally rehearse the engine failure off the catapult emergency procedures. You'll physically move your hand to the emergency jettison button to jettison any stores so that your last muscle memory is where that switch position is. And it's the first thing you check as soon as you come off the catapult. You're checking your end speed, and you're looking at your engines and making sure that they're functioning properly. And if they're not, you're immediately ready to evaluate whether you're safely flying away, jettison any external stores, and get the airplane cleaned up and flying away.
I can only imagine what a rush it is to just get launched off an aircraft carrier. I've seen the film, obviously, of what it looks like when you're going up in the air with the carrier behind you, but to experience it just must be something
else. It's amazing.
It is amazing. Let's talk about something else which is amazing, which is actually being able to be here at Stanford for the year. So,
yes.
National Security Affairs Fellow, that means you spend an academic year here at Hoover on the Stanford campus. Tell me what you've been studying.
So primarily I've been focused on, I would kind of bin it into three areas. One is the impact of fiscal deficits on national defense. I'm deeply concerned about our ability to continue to man and equip a force, in my case the Navy, under the fiscal constraints that are occurring in the country right now with national debt.
Right.
Arguably anywhere between 85 and 105% of GDP if you count, debt owned by investors as opposed to what the government owes itself inside of its own internal accounts. And, you know, CBO projections to 2028, where this is going to get to 150-160% of GDP, to Greek and Italian levels of debt load. And I'm concerned about that at a time when the force has been heavily utilized over the last 2 decades, and it needs to be recapitalized. And we need to invest in a lot of burgeoning new technologies. There's a lot of very interesting technologies, AI and hypersonic weapons and, you know, cyber weapons that could really use incredible and, you know, significant investments to get leap ahead technology into the future. Because our adversaries, that kind of, you know, in this era of sort of great power competition, they've been going to school on the U.S. military. We've been demonstrating our tactics, techniques, and procedures, our equipment, and our capabilities in Afghanistan and Iraq for the last 20 years, and they've watched and they're paying attention, and they have invested in technologies to reach parity. And so in a time like that, I'm deeply concerned about the fiscal situation and its pressure on the defense budget. So I spent a great deal of time looking about and thinking about that issue. Then I've also, the unique thing about Stanford and where it is here in the heart of Silicon Valley is the innovation ecosystem that's here. So I spent a great deal of time auditing classes at the business school that talk about venture capital and technology incubation, and try to understand how the government or the Department of Defense or the Navy can use these techniques to think creatively about solving problems into the future. And I think that one really important takeaway is I feel like Silicon Valley knows how to fail small. Now, they fail big, too, occasionally. But what you see a lot is small investments, incremental, with milestones associated with it, and they are very, it seems like they're very committed to they'll cut bait on something that's a losing proposition fairly early,
right,
and then they concentrate capital on the winning ideas. And I think that the military loses some of that in our innovation ecosystem. We fail big.
Being just too wed to certain programs.
Certain programs. Things change. So, you know, I think right now you're looking at, like, the littoral combat ship in the Navy is a good example. It's a great vessel. It was a great idea when it was conceived in sort of the post-Soviet drawdown, where you could have significant numbers of these vessels with modular platforms based on what mission sets. And we weren't facing great power competition, so they didn't need to be really armored and heavy duty. And 20 years on, this seems like less of a good idea. And so now the Navy's heading to a new frigate design.
Right.
So you get committed to those, and since these really have long tails, 20, 30 years, you know, it would be easier if we could fail smaller or learn those lessons quicker.
But it strikes me, Commander Nordin, it's a very complicated thing you're looking at, in that, first of all, you're obviously dealing with Congress in the matter of appropriations. So when you're talking about construction of programs, they don't like to give up programs because that translates to jobs back home. Second, it also requires the military to be thinking down the road. With the Navy, for example, who are we fighting and where are we fighting 20 or 30 years from now, and what platforms do we need to fight those wars?
Yes, certainly. It isn't easy, right. And I don't want to come off being overly critical, because I understand that it's complex. It's multiple influencers on what decisions are made, and there's no right answer. Right. No one has a crystal ball to predict the future. We're building the fleet today that's going to fight, or hopefully not fight, but is going to underpin our national security 20 or 30 years from now.
Right.
And you make those decisions now. But some of the smaller things where you know, we can look at, kind of trends in society where you know, our manpower costs eat up a great portion of our budget. So mm-hmm. thinking about how we innovate with technology that's here in the Valley to reduce manpower requirements on our vessels and in our platforms, on our bases, what tasks can we find a technological solution to replace manpower, and that reduces your manpower costs. It reduces the legacy costs of pensions and follow-on expenses through the Veterans Administration. And getting those technologies into DOD is often challenging because we kind of go in with a huge program and a program manager and try to solve a lot of problems when, you know, we can use some of these techniques like a min viable product to get, you know, kind of early lessons learned before you really commit a lot of capital.
Right. You mentioned before the podcast that you have been in the Navy now for 20 years?
20 years. 20 years this month, actually.
20 years this month. Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And you are now looking at a posting after this, right?
I am.
Where are you going?
So I'm going to go to nuclear power school, learn how to run a nuclear reactor, and then I'm going to, after that, I'm going to go be the XO, so the second in command of the USS George Washington, which is one of our nuclear-powered aircraft carriers.
Is that the reactor school in South Carolina, or?
It is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I have family in Charleston. I know this very well, actually. They're submarines. They're decommissioned subs, but they're sitting there with reactors, so that's where it'd be, Charleston. We'll have to talk about Charleston when this podcast ends. It's a wonderful place to be.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
My father was a career reservist. He did ROTC for 4 years, then he stayed in the reserves after that. And so I remember growing up each year, he would have to do 2 years of active duty, and he always tried to game the system as best as he could. Sorry, Dad. He wanted to go one of two places, either Treasure Island in San Francisco, which at the time had a naval facility, or Charleston. Those were particularly good trips for him.
Yeah, I'm looking at, we're really excited to go. We're 2 weeks, we're going to hop in the car, drive across the country, and meet our household goods at our new house in Charleston.
I warn you, it might be a little humid when you get there.
Yeah, it's going to be a hot summer. we'll really miss the weather here in the Valley.
You're going to miss the weather very much. So there's an aircraft carrier in your future.
Yes.
All right. Would you like to be a carrier skipper one day?
I would love to. That'd be a great honor.
What is it to be a carrier skipper? Is it a mayor of a large city? Because you're operating a force of about 6,000 people on an aircraft carrier?
So there's right around 5,000.
5,000.
When the air wing is embarked.
That's the whole thing. That's a ship crew plus the air wing and everything involved, logistics, airplane, right?
Right, yeah.
So you're running this floating city, basically, of 5,000 people. What skills does one need to be a carrier skipper?
I think the most important skill is an ability to assess risk mm-hmm. and make appropriate risk decisions. You're primarily navigating one of our nation's capital assets, and so making sure that you're taking due care and due regard to not damage the vessel. And the next most important thing, or equally important, is that there's a nuclear reactor on board.
Right.
And making sure that that is operated with due regard. I think those two things, aside from that, then what you are is you're a leader. You're there to make sure that the crew is well trained and prepared to execute their missions. And then ultimately, it's to put the ship in harm's way when your nation asks you to go win a war.
Interesting. And I'm going to read you a little history. This would have been right about the time when you were falling in love with the idea of flying, but it pertains to aircraft carriers. This would be June of 1982. Israel invades Lebanon in response to an increasing number of provocations by the Palestinians. 8 days later, Israel's laying siege to Beirut, and the United States is watching this, and we fear there's going to be a larger regional war. In response, the Reagan administration does what to bolster its presence in the region? First of all, the Eisenhower, CVN 69, the Eisenhower.
Still
operating, right. We'll get to that in a minute. The Eisenhower and her battle group, which was on station in the Mediterranean, are shifted over. They're joined by the John F. Kennedy, no longer in service, sitting in Philadelphia, I think, which had entered the Mediterranean via the Suez Canal from the Indian Ocean. Then two more carrier battle groups come into play. The Forrestal, no longer with us, and the Independence, no longer with us, join Kennedy and Eisenhower from stateside. So it must come over from Norfolk, I guess. You're now looking at a four-carrier, 50-ship operation with all their air wings at the core off the coast of Beirut. Four carriers. Now, in November 2017, three carriers were off the Korean Peninsula, the Reagan, the Roosevelt, and the Nimitz. The Navy can't do four carriers at one time, I assume. Three seems a stretch. Talk a bit about how we're deploying aircraft carriers. But how many carriers are in the fleet now?
So we've got 11. And there's a discussion of a block buy of two Ford-class carriers.
Right. But of those 11, one is usually in. Does that include one that's in what's called SLEP, right?
Which it is. Since the life of the ship is 50 years, about right. the midpoint of that life, it goes through a deep maintenance period of right. you know 3 or 4 years.
SLEP, right?
Yeah.
Service life extension. Yeah.
And then obviously it's out of you're not deploying.
It's in Newport News for about 2 years, right?
Right.
Right.
Or even longer. Right. And then another portion of the fleet is in maintenance as well, but to a little lesser degree.
Means a carrier sitting at Coronado or Norfolk, and it's come off of a multi-month tour, and so it's just being worked on.
So perhaps it's done two deployments, and it needs right. some deep maintenance before it starts to work up and train up. So
then of that 11 carrier force, Michael, we're looking at really about, what, 7 or 8 carriers that are actually on the move at one time?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that you're operating 8 of them, but we kind of talk about 1 to make 3, or right. 3 to make 1. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 1's in deep maintenance, 1 is training. Mm-hmm. Getting the crew ready and, you know, practicing their skill sets.
Right.
And then the other third is deployed or able to deploy. And then immediately. So you can respond with 3 or 4 carriers and then have several more as they become ready. But you can't do this all the time.
Right.
So this is kind of a, you know, World War III starts tomorrow, I guarantee you we could get a bulk of that fleet to the fight in short order. Mm-hmm. But it does say something about the size of the force. In 1985, we had 585 vessels or surface combatants. Now we're right around 280. We still deploy about 100 vessels mm-hmm. at any given time. So the operational tempo on the remaining hulls and their crews is dramatically higher, and just the quantity is significantly less. So the CNO has articulated a vision of 355 ships by 2030. Mm-hmm. And I think the last couple budget cycles here, it looks like there's room in the budget to kind of realistically achieve that plan. And I think it's critical, particularly at a time when China right now today is operating somewhere around 400 combatants, 66 submarines, and you know another 300
right.
Capital vessels. So,
and they built their own carrier.
They did. So they retrofitted a Russian aircraft carrier,
right?
And they have now produced one carrier indigenously. And I believe it was last week. I think when they first executed
first went out to do trials. I believe.
Well, they did night carrier operations.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. Wow. So I mean, the Chinese Navy has. There's been some dramatic capability enhancements in that force over the last 20 years, and I think it's you know no longer safe to say that the U.S. Navy has technological superiority in sufficient numbers, particularly in that part of the world.
But you would say our carriers are still better than their carrier.
Yes, without a doubt.
Why?
The we've been operating carriers for, you know, nearly 100 years here, nuclear carriers for 50. They're much larger, they're much more powerful, they're nuclear powered. The rate of operations, flight operations that we can sustain are significantly higher. The quality of our air crew in numbers is significantly better. Just the pipeline that we have to train them. So right now we have definite superiority in carrier, in the carrier Navy. And I think maybe less so in other categories.
Right. Well, come the time that you're skippering a carrier yourself, it's going to be a bit of a transition period for the carrier force because we have a new class of carrier coming in, the Gerald Ford.
We do.
Which I believe is now, it's operational. There have been some problems with it, but it's been commissioned.
There's always technical issues when a system of that level of complexity comes online. And they're working through those.
Right.
But some of those are the systems that have been put in place to reduce manpower requirements. So automated systems that once you get them to sea and expose them to seawater and a little bumping around on the waves, maybe don't operate quite like you anticipate, and they'll get that back into the yards and get it fixed up. But it's an incredible machine as well.
And the CVN 78, and this is replacing the Nimitz class, or its successor to the Nimitz class.
It is the successor to Nimitz class.
And speaking of the 50-year model, so the Nimitz was commissioned in 75, I believe. So she's coming up on 50 years pretty soon, and the Eisenhower's a couple years behind that, and the Vinson a few years behind that. Are we going to see these ships leave the fleet at year 50, or do you think we're going to maybe try to cheat another 5 to 10 years out of them? Or so I think the Enterprise, I think
I'd be swimming out of my lane a little bit if I speculated on that. I wouldn't be surprised. I have seen some discussions in the press about perhaps doing a service life extension on one or two of those hulls. So I wouldn't be surprised to see those get extended a little bit longer.
Very interesting. So one other thing might be going on if you're on board an aircraft carrier is you might be involved in the movie business.
That's what I hear.
And this is our segue to your favorite movie, Top Gun. So last week, big news out of Hollywood. Tom Cruise is on North Island. He was in San Diego, and he's begun pre-production for the Top Gun sequel. It's called Top Gun Maverick. And this takes us back to Pete Mitchell. I assume he's not still Lieutenant Pete Mitchell. If he's still Lieutenant Pete Mitchell, something went terribly wrong in his career. But it's the updated version of Pete Mitchell. And what was interesting was they showed a still photo of him at NAS North Island. They'd done a couple days of filming at the San Diego base. And the first thing that struck you was it was all Navy. That there he is. He is wearing his Navy flight suit. He has got his HGU-33 helmet in his hand. And standing behind him in the backdrop was an airplane. What was the plane in the backdrop?
It was an F-18. Super Hornet.
But not an F-35.
Not an F-35.
What is the significance of that, do you think?
The bulk of the current fleet is the F-18.
Yes.
So it's what we're flying off of carrier decks today. Mm-hmm. Now I understand there's a future aspect to the F-35 that would have made it interesting, but it's a pilot's machine, and I think that they're communicating. Maverick's a pilot first and foremost, and that's what they're showing you there.
The photo did not go unnoticed by the branches of the service. It started a little Twitter back and forth, which I thought was kind of funny. Let me read these to you. The Air Force caught wind, caught eye of the photo, and Air Force tweeted out. Its Twitter handle, by the way, is @USAirForce. Here's their tweet. It was, quote, "If Maverick really had a need for speed, he could hop into one of our F-15E Strike Eagles. They have a top speed of 1,875 miles per hour." To which the U.S. Navy responded. The Navy handle on Twitter is @USNavy. They responded, "Remember, boys, no points for second place." To which the Air Force responded, "The F-15 knows nothing about this second place with which you speak. Check out the scoreboard, #undefeated. Then the Air Force Space Command, Twitter's @AFSpace, jumped in and they said, "Want to talk about speed? How about 16,000 miles per hour?"
That's pretty fast.
That's pretty fast. So Pete Mitchell's in an F-18. Let's talk a bit about the film. Now, you mentioned that you saw it as a 13-year-old kid, and it really resonated with you.
It did.
I remember when the film came out in 1986, and what was, I thought, amazing about it. First of all, it resurrected Tom Cruise's career at the time. What I thought was significant was that it celebrated the warrior culture. And this was not an insignificant thing. In the mid-1980s, Hollywood was chunking out movies like Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, and there is still sort of a hangover from Vietnam and the question of the military knowing what it's doing or not. And here's a movie which glorifies Navy life to its fullest and naval aviation. There are parts of that movie which I don't think could hold up in the Me Too time of things in terms of sort of testosterone behavior, but it glorifies what it is to be a naval aviator. So I can see where you were smitten as a 13-year-old. And I think the Navy cashed in pretty well. If I remember, they had recruiting people outside the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think it motivated my entire generation of naval aviators. I mean, we sort of joke. No one would admit in a fighter ready room that they loved this movie as a child. We sort of rib each other about it. But I think at the heart of it, we all there's a special place in all our hearts for that opening scene.
Yes.
When you see him taxiing up to the catapult and the steam rising, and it still motivates me to this day just seeing it.
Okay, that film was came out in 1986, so here we are 32 years later. I know you're not a screenwriter, but if we want to play purist for a moment, Pete Mitchell in 1986 is a lieutenant in the United States Navy. He comes off a very successful engagement. He's a hero. He gets his choice of assignment, and he wants to go back and be an instructor at Top Gun. What happens to Pete Mitchell?
So Pete Mitchell goes back. He teaches at Top Gun, and then he'll go back to a fleet squadron as a department head. So running the operations or maintenance department, he'll become a
CO like you eventually.
In the air wing, and then eventually a CO of a fighter squadron, and then an air wing commander or a commander of an aircraft carrier. And it looks like in this case, he probably was a. Was a squadron commander and maybe an air wing commander, and then went back to Top Gun to run the whole institution.
Okay, so if it's 32 years later, first of all, is he still in the United States Navy? Because he would now be about a 40-year man in the Navy.
Well, perhaps he took advantage of some of the new manpower initiatives that the Chief of Navy Personnel has put in place family leave. He took a three-year hiatus, but realistically, no. I mean, our statutory retirement is 30 years if we don't get promoted to admiral. So, kind of your mid-50s is your last hurrah.
Hey, maybe he came to Hoover as a national security affairs fellow.
Perhaps.
Maybe he ran for Congress. It's been known to happen too, Duke Cunningham. Next question, if he has been hanging around the Navy for 40 years, let's assume he's pushing 60, can he still fly a jet at age 60?
Yeah, you could still fly.
The Navy doesn't have an age limit on aviation?
No. I mean, there's physical limitations. So you're going to have to pass the flight physical and remain current.
The physical is vision and just reflexes and dexterity, all that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, blood pressure and just, you know, standard health. And you need to be in reasonably good physical shape because it is hard on your body. And as a 60-year-old, pulling 7 Gs on a regular basis, it's gonna wear on you. So
I've seen those Mission Impossible movies, though. The guy climbs up the sides of buildings. So let's assume he could still fly a plane. So let's get the benefit of the doubt. Here is, I think, what's going to be interesting about this movie in two regards. Number one, Top Gun, the original, was filmed years before Tailhook came along, the Tailhook scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being filmed in a day in which we are much more sensitive about male behavior. So I'm not sure if it can be the same celebration of manliness that the original was. I don't know if it'll be quite as sort of boisterous as that was.
I don't necessarily think that kind of celebrating that is necessary to the warrior culture.
Exactly.
It's more about camaraderie, and you can have camaraderie and professionalism outside of that kind of behavior, and still have a very successful organization.
Right. Where I'm sorry, go ahead, finish.
No,
Where I do think the movie might head is in a bit of a morality discussion. And that's going to be the question of preparing a pilot to engage in combat. And I think what you might see here is Pete Mitchell trying to train pilots into how to dogfight necessarily. And you and I have talked about this back and forth about this. This is the question about automation when it comes to aviation.
Right.
And you have some thoughts on this.
Yeah. So, I mean, Clausewitz said that warfare is a continuation of politics by other means. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, will we automate? Absolutely. Will we automate fighters? I think we will eventually, someday. I don't think it'll be in my lifetime. I think both Pete Mitchell, myself, and the JOs that were in my squadron when I was a commander are... There's going to be manned fighters for them to fly for the foreseeable future. Now, what you already see today, the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance mission set, that used to be a camera,
right,
strapped to the pod of a fighter off of a carrier deck, and the pilot's flying 200 feet through anti-aircraft artillery and surface-to-air missile systems to take a picture of the sites in Vietnam, for example. Mm-hmm. Those mission sets are almost exclusively the purview of satellites and unmanned aerial vehicles. The Navy in 2023 is going to deploy a carrier-based UAV in a tanker role, and it will probably have some additional capabilities associated with it. So we already see this, and I think in the future, the evolutions that we'll see is, first, you're going to see weapons become a little bit smarter, that are going to do some thinking that humans typically did. The pilot would have done this in the past, and they'll start communicating with each other and making decisions.
So, what kind of decisions? I mean, redirecting on targets, or
yeah. So, a computer algorithm is going to kind of make some decisions there. And then I think what you'll see is a manned fighter with maybe his wingman. Or several of his wingmen are UAVs. But right now, today, the human brain and the human eyeballs it's the best sensor processor combination that we have. Now, will that always be true? No. But I don't think we're at a point now where we can go fully automated in this mission set. And then it's particularly so because in warfare, the electromagnetic spectrum is going to be jammed. It's going to be spoofed. It's mm-hmm. It's going to be denied, and in the end, it's going to be a fighter pilot in a cockpit with a gun that can fight better than the guy that they just merged with and get behind him and shoot him. And it's going to be like that for the foreseeable future if we get into aerial combat when the fog of war degrades to its right. Kind of its essence.
Mm-hmm. How intimate is that dogfighting? We grew up and we look at movies from World War II and Korea and even Vietnam where it's very personal and planes are very close to each other and fighting. Then you watch Top Gun and some of it's personal, but it's also missiles flying at distances. What's the engagement like now between planes?
It's personal. Merging with another jet at 1,200 miles an hour, mm-hmm. And you're only a couple hundred feet away, any error can have catastrophic results pretty quickly. Now, obviously, at the speeds that we're flying, the radius of the turn is different. It's so it's not quite as intimate as maybe it would be in World War II, but it's still the skill set that really separates the best from the rest in fighter aviation, and your ability to really just innately understand the performance of the airplane, the performance of the adversary airplane,
what goes through
how to take advantage of their errors.
What goes through the mind when you're in combat? Do you have a deep thought when you're in the middle of combat, thinking, my goodness, my life is on the line here, this is a defining moment for me? Does it happen in just the blink of an eye and it's over before you know it? Does your training just make you not think about the gravity of the moment? I find this a very curious thing because we all kind of wonder, you know, what we're going to do faced with a crisis in our life. You know, are we going to fight or flee or what have you? But what is it like to actually be in a life or death combat situation?
So if you're well trained, you're just executing what you're trained.
You're just doing your job.
You're just doing your job. And you don't really think about it. Now, sometimes the long transit home after the last tanker is done, and you get a little bit of quiet time with yourself at night, you know, flying back to the ship,
you'll
reflect a little bit, and it's, you know, meaningful. But when you're in the process of prosecuting a target, or you're really relying on your training. And I think that we train so well and in such realistic scenarios that I've never really been surprised when faced with a situation in combat.
Mm-hmm. Your fighters don't panic. You don't, even though your pulse must race, I mean, it must be an adrenaline rush, but you stay in the moment.
You do. You stay in the moment and you execute what you've been trained to do. And the more experienced you get, it sort of becomes a little bit second nature. You've done it enough times that you've kind of seen it before. I mean, I remember when in the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and I'm a young kind of mid-tour lieutenant F-14 pilot, and the first time you have a real MiG on your radar, or the first time you actually see a surface-to-air missile launch, I mean, it gets your attention for sure, but you immediately resort to your training.
Mm-hmm. And training covers all this. Training,
it does.
Right.
Yeah.
There's never been a scenario that you were not prepared for.
No, there hasn't. I mean, I have. It's a pretty rare thing to actually see a surface. I mean, we obviously are not practicing shooting at each other with real missiles. But
look down and say, well, that's interesting.
But you've trained to it enough that you're not surprised by it. You know exactly what it is and what you should do.
Mm-hmm. What do you do on your downtime on a carrier tour?
Read.
Perfect segue. I want to ask you a few questions about reading. Jim Mattis, your boss at the Pentagon. Jim Mattis is
a former Hoover fellow.
Former Hoover fellow, yes. There's life after the Hoover Institution if you want to stay in the military. Jim Mattis is a voracious reader. He is a collector of books. You can go online and find his favorite books. I can direct you to an article where he talks about his 30 things that he thinks are must reading for any warrior, and it's vintage Mattis. There's a lot of stuff here and now, a couple books by Henry Kissinger, but classics. Marcus Aurelius, The Life and Times of Scipio Africanus, Fighting the Carthaginians. What do you like to read?
So I don't think you can ever go wrong following Secretary Mattis's advice there, especially with that reading list. I mean, Secretary Kissinger is excellent. I think that the excellent thing about the classics is that the humanity and the essence of warfare doesn't really change over time. And so there are very rarely new ideas about the essence of warfare, and so I think that's very useful to go back and read the classics. I haven't done that. I mostly read contemporary books and a lot of economic texts. Like I really liked John Kogan's book on the high cost of good intentions this year here, and then World War II naval history, because it's kind of the last time that real, ships that look a lot like the ships we're driving around today were shooting at each other. And so I find it really interesting, particularly Neptune's Inferno, about the early wars around, or early naval battles around Guadalcanal, and just the sheer intensity of those fights, and really kind of try to mentally imagine yourself in this situation and preparing for it. Like, how are you going about training and preparing for these kind of situations? Hopefully it never occurs. Hopefully what we're we're manning a fleet to avoid that. But if it does, I think it's important to have spent some time thinking about what it will look like and you should react. And
we have somebody here in this building who fought on Guadalcanal, George Shultz.
Yes, sir.
Have you talked to him about it?
I have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's always a Marine.
He is. It's funny you mentioned that. If we have roundtables here at the Hoover Institution, somebody comes in and meets with us, and fellows gather around a roundtable, hence the name. And everybody introduces themselves, and Shultz always goes last. And when it's Shultz's turn, he just goes, George Shultz, United States Marine Corps. What is it about the Marine Corps, by the way, that, and this is a question I want to ask him as well, but what is it about the Marine Corps that does that to a man, that just sticks with him like that? And is the Navy the same way? You know, you never say former Marine.
I mean, I'm incredibly proud of my service in the Navy, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. But I do have to say that the Marines as a unit really do. I think they're small because they're small, mm-hmm. And they fight in very small cohesive units. That they develop a sense of esprit de corps, and they're very young service. So, you know, vast majority of them are first term enlistees,
right?
And you know, to bring that disparate group of people and make them a team, it requires a considerable amount of esprit de corps and bravado. And so I think it's just part of their ethos, and it's impressive.
Okay. Final question for you, Commander Nordine. Somebody wants to learn more about what it is to serve and fight for the United States Navy. Steer them to a good book or two to read.
I would read Neptune's Inferno first, mm-hmm. and foremost. And then...
anything about the real-time action?
Present-day?
Present-day Navy, yeah.
I can't think of anything right off the top of my head that I would. I mean, any books about the Falkland War, mm-hmm. I think would be a really good read, because that's the closest modern naval fight. And then it's not current, but Six Frigates, about the original six frigates that the Continental Congress commissioned, I think is a useful read. Because it's about, navies are expensive, they have long tails, so what you build today, you're using 30 years from now, and there's a lot of politics surrounded with building a fleet.
Okay. Michael Nordine, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
On behalf of everybody listening, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, in this case, the United States Navy. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to download, and have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Commander Michael Nordine and his fellow Hoover National Security Affairs fellows to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. Commander Nordine, are you on Twitter or not?
I am not.
You're not. Do you plan to stay that way?
I do.
Run silent, run deep, right? Well, again, good luck. Enjoy Charleston. Try to stay cool if you can. I will keep an eye on you. Good luck with the career. And it's been a pleasure having you at Hoover for the last year.
Pleasure.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.